So the end point here is kind of about, like, politics. Or if that doesn't seem interesting to you when we get there, we can talk about, like, teaching. Or we can just stop.
I haven't really been paying attention to politics. Is there anything
going on?
Nothing much is happening these days.
That's good. I don't watch the news or listen to the news or read the news.
Uneventful.
We are recording, right?
Oh, yeah.
Faculty Futures Lab is a faculty-led effort to consider the challenges facing institutions of higher education in complex and uncertain times. All guests speak from their own expertise and experience. Produced by the San Diego State University Center for Teaching and Learning. Learn more at ctl.sdsu.edu.
See? Done.
Okay. I need like a one Mississippi of silence,
okay,
people.
Okay, I'm sorry. Uh-oh.
It's contagious.
Welcome to Faculty Futures Lab. I'm Dr. DJ Hopkins. I'm a professor at San Diego State University, and I'm in the podcasting studio of the SDSU Digital Humanities Center with my regular co-host, Dr. Pam Lack. Hi, Pam.
Hey, DJ.
Listeners who have been following the current season know that we've been talking to colleagues whose professional activity blurs the distinction between theory and practice. But what you may not know is that in addition to being the co-director of our university's Center for Teaching and Learning, I've got a side hustle as the director of our university's Center for the Study of Media and Performance. It's a little center on our campus, and sometimes the work for this center looks like conventional scholarship in the arts. But most of the time, the Center for the Study of Media and Performance focuses on art that's blurring the distinction between theory and practice, or, as another colleague once put it, art as a mode of critical inquiry. Today on Faculty Futures Lab, these two different worlds of mine meet in the same podcasting studio. I'm excited to be talking theory and practice with two guests, Adam Manley and Carrie Ann Quick. They probably don't see their own work quite the way I do, but I can't wait to talk about it. Adam, Carrie, welcome to the Faculty Futures Lab.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Our guests are professors in SDSU's School of Art and Design. Professor Carrie Ann Quick is an associate professor of jewelry and metalwork. Quick has a Bachelor of Arts in Applied Design from here at San Diego State and an MFA in Metal from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Quick has a remarkable exhibition record. Check out their full bio at the link in our show notes. Professor Adam Manley is an Associate Professor of Furniture Design and Woodworking at San Diego State. Adam has taught at numerous institutions, from colleges to craft schools, and has exhibited his work nationally. Again, full bio and link to Adam's personal website in the show notes. Together, our guests are the co-founders of Craft Desert, a short-run publication focused on contemporary craft. Adam, Carrie, thank you so much for sitting down with us.
You are welcome.
Thank you.
Carrie, I left a lot out of your bio, as I did with Adam's, but there's one phrase in your official bio on the university website, and I want to return to it because I think it's a gem. Quoting, Quick's research is rooted in exploring craft as a cultural phenomenon, unquote. I love that sentence, but I can't quite wrap my head around how it manifests itself in your practice. What does exploring craft as a cultural phenomenon look like?
So I think that it means to pay specific attention to the way that we physically manifest our culture through objects. So we physically embed our values, our rituals, our religious affiliations, our political affiliations in the objects that we surround ourselves with. And with jewelry in particular, our betrothal rituals are worn on the body. Our coming of age rituals are worn on the body. In, say, like furniture, you know, the Shakers, they manifested their religious simplicity, utility, what's the third thing, Adam? I forgot. Simplicity, utility.
Too on the spot for me.
Honesty.
Oh.
Into their furniture design. And so we see this over and over and over. The modernists did it. Mm-hmm. The Catholic Church did it with the Baroque style.
Yeah.
We see it over and over. And so I'm interested in paying attention to the way that I personally make, but also when I think about the work of other crafts people, I want to pay attention to how their culture is helping them make aesthetic choices and functional choices. How's that?
No, I love that so much.
I really do. Adam, do you care to respond to what Carrie was just saying? Does that reflect your work?
Yeah, I think Carrie and I have a pretty similar outlook on like how objects fit into the world and our lives, and it's kind of where Craft Desert came from, I think, is from this similar outlook on how the object reflects personal histories, shared histories, cultural moments in time.
Yeah.
Yeah. in all of our lives. I mean, my interest in furniture, I started as actually more of like a furniture designer and maker, and so now I'm sort of making more art through that process. But I think that happened as a result of being more interested in that phenomenon than the actual working with a client to create something functional for their lives.
I almost think about it as like a pre, of course, now my brain just like drained of all thoughts.
That happens. It's the microphone's fault.
It is the microphone's fault. It's like pre-archaeological way of looking at something, or like an ethnographic way of looking at something. Mm. Like when I say pre-archaeological, I'm instead of looking at what a culture did in the past, I'm trying to like dig into what we're doing in the present that expresses our culture through material. Mm. The way that we are manifesting our lives, really, through material now.
Mm-hmm. This is perfect. This really helps me understand the two of you, because I was thinking to myself, how did two people who I previously understood probably reductively as craftspeople, how did these two people decide to collaborate on a publication? And now these perspectives really help me understand. It seems like Craft Desert is the natural extension of your shared interest. And before I go any further, I just want to clarify for our listeners, Craft Desert is not a magazine. It is not a journal. It is not a zine. You've called it a zernal.
It's a zernal.
Okay.
And it's a new category, and we're going to hold on to that.
We crafted that category. I love that category.
We smithed that category.
So DJ was supposed to bring a copy of the zernal for me to see and didn't, so I have not seen it yet.
But
surprise!
Oh, well, we're going to break the
zernal,
rules.
You get a zernal.
You should just set that down like on the table.
I brought visual props for an audio format.
Oh, my gosh.
It's a big box filled with handcrafted zernals.
Gorgeous.
Zernal issues.
Yes. So this is, we brought this for you to look at and to see the glory of our zernal collection.
It is collected at the SDSU library as well. But not in such a special package.
Right.
Carrie and I are the only ones who have this particular packaging.
Because we're special.
Oh, it's unique. No, there's two.
I want you to hear the flipping of the pages in the recording. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And look, there's things added into the publication.
Each issue has a swag page, something branded with our special branding.
So what phrasing... What's the terminology that you use to describe the publication process? Is it short run? Is it small batch? Is it handcrafted? Because you would publish like 100 issues or 100 copies of each issue?
Give or take, yeah. We would publish as many as there were subscribers at that moment, plus a handful.
And it's spiral bound, but it's got die cuts. It's got multiple different paper stocks.
That's laser cut.
Pardon me.
Oh,
I was trying to decide how old school is this, so I went with
there
die cut.
Die cut elements, but that one in particular is laser cut.
Yeah, I mean, we think about it as a zine, right? It's made on a copier. We're doing all the layouts ourselves. We're binding it ourselves. We're trimming it ourselves. The covers are all kind of custom done in some way. So the first one was laser cut. We did different things to different ones. Actually, we have one called Desserts that has, Condiments.
Condiments.
The condiments theme. We stained the cover to look like, you know, you had put your coffee on it or like some ketchup had gotten.
Yeah. Love that.
So we really tried to think about them as handmade objects, and we put effort into them as though they were handmade objects, even though it was cereal. But the content is more like a journal.
Mm-hmm.
There is some scholarly effort put into the content, but we just didn't want it to feel so stuffy. So we avoided calling it a journal. to be able to make it feel more open for anyone to read, mm-hmm. craftspeople, mm-hmm. scholars, and right. appreciators of craft right. in general.
And right. as kind of object obsessives, both of us, the craft object of the thing was very right. important. The kind of how it felt in your hands and, you know, the weight of the paper. We spent probably a silly amount of time trying out different papers.
And I love
like
that.
The spiral-bound part was also kind of like, there's a little bit of an academic journal element, but we were thinking more like instructional manuals, shop mm-hmm. manuals, things mm-hmm. that you can spread open on a surface and, like, read while you're doing something.
I was just thinking, an academic journal might have excellent content, but it is never itself an object worth keeping. I have edited numerous academic journals and have felt really attached to them. And also recently, I just recycled 2 medium-sized moving boxes of academic journals mm-hmm. because the content is what matters and I have access to that. And the things themselves had no value to me at all, even if they had an interesting cover. Whereas this, it both has exciting content and is itself very clearly an art object.
Thank you. We tried.
So what made the two of you think, I know, we've got to make a publication that is itself an art object while also filled with a world of ideas?
It was Adam's idea.
I don't know if that's blame or... I was teaching at the Maine College of Art for 5 years, and while I was there, I started a publishing project with the head of the Institute for Contemporary Art that was there. And it was this, like, micro-publishing, art micro-publishing thing where we, long story short, is that there's an organization called Publication Studios that started in Portland, Oregon, and has popped up these locations all over the world. But we were a branch of Publication Studios doing art publications specific to people in Portland, Maine. Mm-hmm. And when I moved here for this job in 2016, Carrie had been here for a year, and I had just published my last project with that, which was actually a sci-fi speculative science fiction novel by Nato Thompson, the curator, who has like a side project of writing fantasy and science fiction. Hmm. And I knew that I had to kind of move on from that project because I had this new academic job. But Carrie and I were talking about the project, and I liked the publishing part, and we wanted mm-hmm. to collaborate on something. And I came with all this equipment. Bookbinding equipment. So we kind of had the stuff, and Craft Desert was born from that.
Yeah, we kind of broed out over like the idea that craft, the category of craft, is both over and underused. Like, you can think about in our first, or actually in our second issue, we featured like a lowrider painter. Mm-hmm. So thinking about care and skill, material, deep knowledge, as the primary criteria for craft. Mm-hmm. And so if you think about it like that, it isn't about a material or it isn't about the specific outcome, but it's about a way of approaching something. And so the Craft Desert name, we were thinking about like food deserts and how in our country there are places that are kind of recognized as centers of craft, and this is not one of them. Hmm. However, wow. That is completely false, right?
Yeah, it's an unfair designation.
And so we thought about the desert as a vibrant place where things mm-hmm. may look dead or dormant, but actually below the surface they are boiling, literally boiling mm-hmm. with activity.
You are blowing my mind right now.
And thank you.
This is a super bloom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
In a desert, right?
Yeah.
This is the craft desert that I'm holding in my hands. Like, mm-hmm. right? The desert is full of life. I love that. Oh, so exciting.
And the logo, the iconic graphic of Craft Desert, is a particular kind of cactus.
Tis, yes.
Even, from Baja. Even the development of the logo was really fun. Like, we found an online cattle brand generating app.
And go on.
We put in you can basically put in, like, if you had a ranch, you could put in the name of your ranch and it will just pump out possible cattle brand logos.
And we forgot about that.
Craft Desert, never forget. Mm-hmm. We put in Craft Desert and somewhere in there was this image of an elephant cactus. Mm-hmm. And it also is vaguely reminiscent of like a six-fingered hand.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. So it was like, it just felt, we modified it slightly, but like it just felt too perfect that it was like generated automatically. And we do have a brand made also.
Yeah, we actually made a brand.
This box is branded with a... Addison Delisle.
Addison Delisle.
That's so cool.
At Haystack made us a brand. Thank you, Addison.
It's kind of ironic using an auto-generated app to develop the brand for this handcrafted Zornal. Did I say that right?
Yeah.
I love that. I love that juxtaposition.
I mean, I think that's part of it. It's like we're not Luddites and we're not anti-technology. We understand machines and technology as an extension of the hand, as a craft tool. And so there are no restrictions.
Yeah.
This is not like craft in some kind of like archaic sense. This is craft now,
and
here.
It's right. Like worked into the whole philosophy of the project, this kind of idea that, especially in academia, I think we think of craft as meaning these sort of four material practices, five at best, and that's far too restrictive and exclusionary also. And kind of if you step back one step, you can kind of see its fingers in almost every all these different worlds.
Yeah.
In an academic context, is there often a distinction made between art and craft? And I'm asking that because a few minutes ago, I referred to Craft Desert as an art object. And I'm wondering if maybe you don't associate that phrase with this. I meant it as a compliment, but maybe it's not one that you would use.
I'm not offended by it.
Mm-hmm.
However, I think of it as a craft object because of the skill and effort and knowledge and all the things that we kind of like those criteria. But there's also, yes, in academia, there are distinctions. It's a long and tired argument.
Right.
Oh, God.
I'm sure. A false dichotomy that
completely
elevates one form over another, I'm sure.
But in craft, there is a implied function that I think is important. Mm. Where an art object, you don't touch a painting. You look at a painting and you engage with it visually or intellectually, but you don't really use it. I mean, its use is maybe to make you think or to look good over your couch. No offense, painting. Everyone, no offense to painting.
Are there painters in the room right now?
Yes. Oh, God. But there is a kind of implied tactility, a haptic kind of engagement that happens with craft objects more often. And the Zernal is to be touched, is to be used, is to be dog-eared. You're supposed to take that swag out. You're supposed to use the swag. It has a physical connection to the body. And that's, for me, that is the kind of distinction between art and craft. And there's lots of overlap and messiness there. We touch art sometimes, too. We almost always touch craft.
I think like something that like Carrie brought up, the kind of like how material in particular can tell stories. And I think one thing that often happens in craft is like the use of materials from, well, I'm looking at this box. This is made from a 1930s piano made in Chicago I dismantled. And like nobody knows that or has to know that. But there's something important to me about that as the person who made it and maybe the people who own it, like Carrie and myself. But like there's so much embedded in material and process that is maybe just for us.
Yeah.
Often.
All this discussion of the power of objects to convey information, to contain histories, even if those histories aren't immediately visible, serves as the perfect transition to talking about your curatorial project, Becoming Heirlooms. Adam, Carrie, recently there was a brief announcement on our campus about your project, Becoming Heirlooms. I had never heard of it before, but I was immediately fascinated. What can you tell us about Becoming Heirlooms and how it came to be?
I mean, it's an extension of our Craft Desert project.
I see that.
Craft Desert, in addition to being a publication, is a curatorial collaboration, and we've made two exhibitions so far, one called Small Acts and another called Material Witness. And probably just by those words, you can detect that the themes in Craft Desert are made manifest in those exhibitions. And Becoming Heirlooms is our third and most ambitious stab at a curatorial endeavor, hopefully a major museum exhibition.
So it's not just that it seems to me like a logical extension of your editorial work on Craft Desert. It is an extension of your curatorial work on Craft Desert.
Yeah, we are Craft Desert.
Yeah, yeah. And Becoming Heirlooms is...
It's a Craft Desert production.
In physical space.
Yeah.
It was kind of a natural move towards curatorial projects, I think. I mean, we've talked about this. Like, we kind of think of the Zernal... Mm-hmm. as a sort of curatorial project also. Like this is the first issue. We wrote everything in the first issue. And then after that, it was kind of like, we have a theme. We have some people we would like to have someone write about. And mm-hmm. we have someone who we would like to do that writing. And sort of putting all that together was the project of the publication.
And similarly for an exhibition, yeah. we created a theme that we think is important. And we are putting together a checklist of artists whose work address that theme mm-hmm. in compelling ways so that we can manifest it in physical space. I'm using the word manifest a lot today.
I think it's okay.
Okay, cool. Yeah.
You're trying to manifest.
I am I'm like really about manifesting. I went out at the eclipse, you know, and I was like, anyway.
So what is the theme of Becoming Heirlooms? How would you articulate it beyond the two-word title?
So it's an exhibition of craft and design objects that capture some collective experience of the present mm-hmm. that will, in the future, help us remember that collective present moment.
Mm. And if it's sort of helpful to think about, that, as we were thinking about titles, there was like, one idea was sort of future heirlooms or future, mm-hmm. We were thinking about.
There's like a time travel
the kind
aspect.
Of like the object that is taken with you after some experience or some trip or something meaningful to you.
The time travel part is like, what is being made now mm-hmm. that will help us remember today, tomorrow?
So it's not a historical thing. Like you're bringing something that is objectively already right now an heirloom, like a 100-year-old quilt, and talking about how it became an heirloom. You're talking about something that has just been made that has a kind of inbuilt potential
yes.
to become it heirloom.
It's about potential. And it isn't always all about today. So we've given ourselves a time frame. So it's from 2001, from 9/11. A major collective experience to today and all of those collective experiences along the way. That's the exhibition will mark that chunk of time.
But what's amazing about what you ask is that will include, like, the quilt continues to tell those stories.
Yeah.
So that doesn't exclude quilts as some kind of antiquated take on this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting to me. So I was originally trained as a historian. And the thought I keep having, I was in my second year of my doctoral program when 9/11 happened. Mm. And I, ever since then, have been thinking about these moments where, like, as a historian, I'm living through a moment that I know is historic and will be studied, starting with 9/11. Mm-hmm. And I have this feeling a lot, and I've had it a lot recently, of like, this is a moment we need to remember and capture this moment. And it's weird thinking about, like, history, the future of history through the present. Mm-hmm. And I'm not necessarily thinking through objects per se, but of course that makes so much sense, right? Like when you're in a moment and you're like, I have to remember this moment. I'm going to work really hard to remember this moment. So of course you forget the moment. The idea of almost anchoring us to now and the future. That's so cool.
This project's really important to me aside from our collaboration. Like my work has kind of been moving in this direction also more personally. And like 9/11 happened my first week of college. I went to college in the Hudson Valley in New York. So it like, I got a political science degree because that happened. Mm-hmm. Like my entire life is shaped from that moment. So there's this cultural bigger picture thing, but also like my adult life is this moment. Wow. Basically from exactly starting at the same moment from which we're collecting works for this show.
Wow.
So do you already have a list and do you already have destinations where the exhibit will be presented? And does the list shift based on where it might be presented? That's three questions.
Can we just say yes?
Yes.
Great. Thank you very much.
Okay, that's been it.
Another podcast.
Yes. We do have a list that we are not at liberty to share yet.
Uh-huh.
We do have a potential partner, venue partner, which mm-hmm. we are not currently at liberty to share.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And if that partner does not work out, yes, the mm-hmm. checklist, it is highly likely that the checklist will shift according to where the work is shown. Mm-hmm. Now, what you didn't mention about the announcement made on the San Diego State University campus was mm-hmm. that the project is being supported by a National Endowment for the Arts grant, mm-hmm. a visual arts grant. Mm-hmm. And as you may or may not know, there are things happening in our country that have put grant funding in peril.
Hmm. Tell me more.
Well, there's nothing to tell you. We are just waiting to see if the award actually happens.
We were told that we received the award in November.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a process that would have taken some amount of time to actually have it come to us, right. However that happens, because I haven't gotten one before.
But we're recording in March.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And there is, as of now, no word on what...
Radio silence.
Yeah, we have no idea what will happen with that, which is partly why we can't really talk about
mm-hmm.
the works that we hope to have it in it, have right. in it. And right. also, like, if it comes through, we would have different works than if it doesn't, or can it even happen?
We're non-committal at this point. Yeah. I mean, we're also, I think, I think we also don't want to jinx ourselves. Like, mm-hmm. there's an aspect right. of superstition for me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay,
you know?
I also want to, though, there's another interesting part of your question, I think, about does it change based on venue is so
mm-hmm.
craft is very linked to place also. So mm-hmm. for us, if it happens in San Diego, for instance, we want to include some works that actually have some specific connection to the place in which right. it's being exhibited. And if it happens somewhere on the other side of the country, we want to make sure that there's it's like an important part of craft is that there are these kind mm-hmm. of vernaculars and, mm-hmm. and the histories in different places
yeah.
that are important.
For all the reasons you said, Craft Desert comes out of its San Diego situatedness with the cacti and the super blooms and the lowriders and surfboards and all the things that are part of craft culture, and of course there's many other things and all these issues than a handful of things I just mentioned, but I can imagine an exhibit that happened in San Diego would be different from an exhibit that might happen in Chicago or New York City, and there could be opportunities to, well, would you take opportunities to use craft objects that were particular to a city, a location? Could be New York City, could be Hudson Valley.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important for us to consider the audience. I think we want our audience, no matter where the exhibition takes place, mm-hmm. to see themselves there. Because right. craft, yeah. again, haptic, we have this personal, intimate relationship with objects. So we want the audience to feel themselves reflected, their collective experience. Mm-hmm. They are part of the collective experience. So
right.
so thinking about how maybe something that we experience as a country may have manifest again,
mm-hmm.
may have come into being
mm-hmm.
in the South versus right. the Pacific Northwest
yeah.
is interesting and respectful, too.
Right.
I mean, the exhibition will represent like a whole range of
yeah.
regions, but we definitely want some element of it to
yeah.
speak specifically to where it's located.
Our checklist that we cannot tell you anything about mm-hmm. has
if
artists from
exists.
Yeah.
What checklist?
Has artists from all around the country currently.
Yeah.
I mean, every region is, and we've been very thoughtful about
the representation.
Yeah, the backgrounds of the artists that we're inviting so that we're ensuring that we're really thinking through the collective, not as a white male or dominant mm-hmm. culture collective. We're trying to mm-hmm. think of collectives and sub-collectives and then the larger collective. So.
Sort of as big a picture as possible.
Yeah.
Right. So we can't talk about, for understandable reasons, the things that might be on your list, if there is a list. But I'm sitting in this recording studio with this beautiful box set of issues of Craft Desert, looking at the box itself sitting on the table in front of Pam in two different kinds of wood, which, as Adam said earlier, were salvaged from an antique piano. And that's not visible to me. There's nothing about the features of this box that suggests once was piano. But is this the kind of object that has could become heirloom qualities?
I mean, I guess yes, potentially, but I think it is a craft exhibition. We're thinking about artists and craftspeople and designers who are engaged in some level of functionality or implied functionality. So even if it's a chair that you can't sit on, you can think about it in the domestic space, like you recognize it as something that may exist in the domestic space. So
at least referencing these.
Yeah.
Functions.
So there will be jewelers, there will be furniture makers, there will be people who do basketry, there will be textile artists represented in the exhibition whose work addresses some kind of collective moment in our recent history as a country.
Okay, so I want this to happen, and I want to be there, and I want to see this, whatever it may be. But what if it doesn't happen? What's the alternative? And by what if it doesn't happen, what if the NEA folds? What if the NEA decides it's going to go on pause and not give any awards? Not that it wouldn't happen, but what's your plan B if the NEA grant doesn't come through?
I mean, we've got all kinds of, like, other irons in the fire. NEA is not our only sugar daddy or mama or person. But if it could not be physically possible to make it into an exhibition, I think Craft Desert, the publication, would step in.
Yeah, I think that we've had exhibitions in the past on almost no budget, but this seems like it requires, there's a level of work that we want to be borrowing. There's an institutional, like, level we really want to hit with this project.
We want to pay artists.
Yeah, we want to pay artists. We want to tap makes into sense. Some art. A lot of this list that might not exist has some really major works on it that would have to be borrowed from major institutions. So that it's not, there's not really a low budget version of it. So I think it sounds like we would start with a publication, basically.
Basically, we would put the cart in front of the horse and make the catalog before the exhibition existed.
Oh,
and maybe using that to find support, basically, using that publication.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah. It becomes a kind of proof of concept.
Yeah.
And going back to what you already do so well, I'm gesturing here to some of the copies of Craft Desert in front of me and creating a catalog raisonné that, as you just said, precedes an actual exhibition, perhaps as a way of saying, this is what the exhibition could be.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Don't you want to be in the room with all this awesome stuff?
Don't you want to send us money?
Donors, hello, out there.
Right. Yeah.
One last question. Why do people want to be in a room with awesome stuff? Because I could just look at pictures of awesome stuff.
Nah, man.
Pictures are not haptic.
Well, I think that there's a level of engagement and emotional response that we have when we're physically in a space with something that is not always achievable when you look at the photograph. So, like, understanding scale or material, even, like, smell, like, things that you don't even know, senses that you don't even know that you're engaging, the sound of something obviously cannot be transmitted through a photograph.
I'm not a very mystical person, but I do think that there's something mystical about it, about the physical presence of objects, and whether you can touch it or not, there's something that happens when you can stand in the space with something.
Right.
I think Charles Ray has this, like, comment about, he made this piece that's like a solid stainless steel tractor, I think, full size, solid cast stainless steel, I guess, and, like, or machined or something.
Yeah.
And he has this mystical idea of, like, you feel the weight of the object, whether you know how heavy it is or that it's solid or not. Like, you feel the physical weight of this, like, 4-ton tractor.
Yeah, Donald Judd talked about this, too. It's like you understand your own physical body in space better with something else mm-hmm. in space.
Yeah.
Just referring on a much more mundane level to an example you used a few minutes ago, Adam, you gave the example of a chair that might be the result of the work of a craftsperson, but it's an art object and somebody shouldn't sit in it. But if I'm looking at a photograph of that, I'll recognize its chairness. I'll see what its potential purpose could be, but it's a photograph. If I'm in the room with this chair, the potential to sit in it is immediate.
Mm-hmm. You're so tempted.
I'm right there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that quality of potential to sit in the presence of the chair is something that's really only achievable in physical space and yeah. in proximity to the object, especially when you're talking about a group of objects meant to be used.
I mean, the tractor, I think, is a really good example because you look at the tractor on a photograph and it is 8x5 or whatever the photo is, whatever mm-hmm. the photo size is. But to understand physical, a full-size tractor
mm-hmm.
is enormous.
Yeah.
And then to put your physical body in juxtaposition with that mm-hmm. enormous object, you're like, oh, mm-hmm. well, there's like a aha. I mean, and that's scale is mention, like the most like, basic.
The other physical senses. Yeah. Like I just like as a material lover and nerd, yeah. like the texture of a thing, even if I can't touch it, is visible when you can stand right over it. Or like the sound in a space changes when objects are in it.
Yeah. 100%.
Smell. Like a solid stainless steel tractor probably smells like something.
Yeah. Everything smells like something. I have a very keen like sense something. Of smell. Everything smells like something.
Mm. That's why I don't work in metal as much. Like
I love the smell of metal.
One of the things I like working in the material with my hands, the smell really throws me off.
Yeah.
I don't like it.
There's this weird connection happening for me right now, listening to y'all talk about all of this stuff. And it's evoking for me like the act where typically tourists, will go to a space or a place, take a picture of the thing, but not actually engage with the thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking about, you know, like people, you know, Americans who go to Pisa and make it look like they're holding the tower, or people who go to the Louvre to get that picture of the Mona Lisa, but they haven't actually engaged with it.
Right.
And we're talking about an exhibit of craft things that are telling this collective history in the moment and engaging with it in a way, whether it's in person or whether it has to be through a publication. And I'm feeling I don't even know how to articulate this, but I see you nodding, Carrie, and I think maybe you understand what I'm trying to get at, and maybe you could just finish my thought for me because I'm definitely struggling. But there's something happening here that I can't. And maybe that's the whole purpose of this exhibit.
I mean, I would not presume to finish your thought.
But, please go ahead.
But no, I think that's why when we conceived of the project, we did not conceive of it as a publication. It's a lesser, no offense to publications, but it does not fully encapsulate the experience that we're trying to create and to not only create it between objects, there will be a relationships between the objects in the room, but also between the viewer and the object, and also between the viewers and other viewers, understanding that they are looking at something that they both have a connection to, they experienced it from
relationships, relational experience of these things.
Yeah.
It's not just about exhibiting objects. It's creating a community of people who come to be in the room with the objects.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is what's so cool about curation, which I'm new to. Like, we've started doing these projects and I've curated some smaller shows. But this idea of having an opportunity to, like, create relationships between people and objects and objects and objects and objects and architecture and people all in the same at the same time.
Having a shared experience.
Yes.
Which is, I imagine, ultimately what you want to try to create.
That is
becoming
correct.
Heirlooms. Well, I hope I get to see it.
Me too.
I hope I get to see it too.
Yeah.
I hope we get to make it, and then I hope we get to see it.
It's going to be awesome.
It's going to be awesome.
It's going to
happen. Some way or another.
I'm
going to
manifest
awesome.
It.
Yeah. If you're going to start manifesting, manifest this.
Yeah.
Carrie, Adam, thank you so much for joining us on Faculty Futures Lab.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah.
This was rad.
It was great to
talk with you. Fun. Yeah.
This is a total non sequitur. So I am someone who always thought of myself as a non-crafty person, who has recently described myself as craft curious, as I've moved into the world of crafting.
Welcome.
Through a community. Well, it's through a community of digital humanists, which is my sort of disciplinary home. It's a group of folks who make physical things, but also work with the digital. And we call ourselves, there's a hashtag DHMakes, and we share what we do. And I started making a data physicalization of my sleep rather than using an app to track it and sort of doing the bio data thing. I track it manually in a notebook, and then I stitch it in embroidery. And I'm terrible at it, but, like, I love doing it. And now I'm learning how to weave the San Diego Craft Collective. Oh. Which is an amazing place.
Started
if I can put a plug in for them.
I love it.
Founded by an alum.
Yeah. Oh really? I didn't know that.
Excellent. Oh, Steffi Dotson.
Oh, that's awesome. Anyway, let me see if I can get a question out of this.
I've got a question out of this because I've often looked at your data visualizations of your sleep because you post them on social media and you've even got a poster of one.
In my office.
In your office. And it never occurred to me to put together what you're doing with all of my professional interests. But of course, what you're doing is producing art as a mode of critical inquiry. And you are making a craft object that has all kinds of aesthetic value, but is absolutely an object that serves a variety of purposes.
Yeah, and a lot of folks like to emphasize the tactileness of of this work. The, like, if you think about data as comprised of digits and sort of the oldest kind of coding, right, is weaving. And there are folks who do woodworking, folks who make zines and do letterpress and all sorts of things. And it's a way to kind of slow things down. We're not rejecting technology, certainly, but, like, thinking about the tactileness of the things we do. And, gosh, I'm still struggling to articulate this because I'm still very new to this world, but I don't know. Something that you're saying is really resonating with me, and I just was like, I got to share this.
I think it also gets to the thing we were talking about at the very beginning, where craft has, throughout time, been kind of used as a way to mark things down, to take record of something, to, like, tell a story of the time we're living in, either personally or culturally. Like, I have a Afghan drone rug, which is, like, something that I coveted for a very long time and finally bought myself one, but... There's a long history in Afghan rug weaving of telling the story mostly of the wars they've been involved in. And so, like, in the 80s, there are these rugs that have, like, Soviet weaponry on them. And and then during the 2000s, the drones start to show up in these rugs. And this object, which is, like, I'm a little concerned about some things about it. Like, I don't feel totally comfortable having it all the time, but as this, like, object and a record of our time that's being made in the middle of the thing that I've lived through most of my adult life. It's this incredible recording, sort of. And I think that, like, that's how craft gets used around the world.
Yeah, totally. I mean, this is really what we were talking about at the start, you know, how craft is a way to express our values and the things that we care about. And in jewelry and in weaving in particular, in textile techniques, but in jewelry, it's used as a mnemonic device. Like, whether or not someone can look at it and read your code.
Right, right.
It doesn't matter. It's about you making that record.
Yep.
And perhaps that could be unlocked by the right person or the right whatever, if you give them that kind of entrance into understanding what you've done. But it's important to you to make that record and to make that mark.
Yeah. There's that quilting. This is huge in quilting,
yeah,
right?
Totally. Yeah, totally. It's funny, whenever I post pictures, I post every time I make progress on my visualization, and people are like, oh, what do the things mean? And I won't give them the key, right? I'll say, well, the colors of the Z's of the floss represent amounts of sleep, and the beads represent types of awakeness. And that's all I'll say. So you can infer things in the visualization, but only I can read it.
Yeah.
And I love that, especially as someone concerned about data privacy and surveillance and stuff like that. And just recently, not to get too political, but someone was like, well, why would you do that? And I said, well, what if you replaced what I said about, like, I don't want to use a sleep app with, I don't want to use a period tracker.
Yeah.
And then immediately people get it. And they're like, oh, I see why you're doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not all people, but, you know, the people I talk to.
Yeah.
Certain circles.
Yeah. It's, what you're doing is it's not a common strategy, but it is a strategy that exists in our world. And it's totally valid and awesome. And I love that you're doing it. I want to see them.